Our data center is in chaos.
Fire, fire, fire.
No.
Let's do this. What is virtualization?
You're going to learn today.
Innovate like a startup. Deliver like an enterprise.
I hope you're coffeeed up and ready because it's going to be a great day.
I know you're going to dig this.
Oh, yeah.
You're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast with Pedro Lero and John Nicholson.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Virtually Speaking Podcast, episode number 109. My name is Pete Fletcher, a.k.a. Pedro Arrow, and joining me straight from the rodeo is Mr. John Nicholson. John, welcome back, partner.
Ugh, the body is sore, but it was a good day, so.
Yeah.
Got to see Zac Brown Band, so.
Oh, okay. Is that a country singer?
Oh, God, Pete. Oh, God. Sonic Highways. They were on with Foo Fighter.
It was the Nashville stuff. Oh, okay. Now, okay. That's all you had to say. As long as you can relate it to the Foo Fighters, then I know who you're talking about.
This is going to be our advertisement. For anyone who hasn't seen Sonic Highways, I think it's on HBO Go. Amazing. Like, we're not getting paid. Completely worth. If you enjoy music across all genres, absolutely worth watching.
Yeah, very nice. Sonic Highways was awesome, and I remember that guy. I didn't know his name, but I knew there was like some muscle rocker, but kind of country dude that did that with them. That was pretty awesome.
Yep. That would describe them.
But I'm glad you're back for this one because, John, this is one we've been holding on to for a little while. We collected these things that we titled Fire, Flood, and Blood.
Fire, Flood, Blood.
Exactly. And basically what these are a collection of stories from people in the IT industry. Maybe there was a fire, maybe there was a flood, maybe there was blood. Maybe it was more like just a mistake that they made or a lesson learned, something that, that one IT story that you probably tell when you're out with the group at a bar or something. And so, John, why don't we kick it off? Why don't you give me an example of one of your data center disaster or recovery type stories?
Well, you know, anytime I dealt with disaster in the data center, I could always put on my hat and my boots and say, this isn't my first rodeo, but I won't talk about the first hurricane I dealt with. I'll talk about the second, which was actually up in the Northeast. It was Sandy, I think it was. Yeah, Hurricane Sandy. Mm-hmm. So I was not in the Northeast for this one. I smartly live in, you know, Houston to protect myself from hurricanes because we never get those. So at the time I was working for a managed service provider and we provided services to some cities and schools up there and some other customers. And, you know, Sandy was coming in and we get this call and it's you know, from one of our customers up there. And they're like, hey, we can't get to the data center. We don't, you know, what's going on, but we're getting, you know, a bunch of alarms. And, you know, we look at them and we're seeing the alarms too. And, you know, everything, all the thermal alarms are actually going off on all the servers and all the storage arrays. And we're like, well, this data center was in an old city hall basement, this old rock building. And we're like, well, can anyone get there? And they're like, no, even the fire department's not going to leave the station right now. It's a complete mess. And the guy's like, oh, by the way, my windows are starting to bow in. Like, if I drop this call, can you all just deal with this?
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm sitting in my conference room, you know, and it's about 73 degrees, you know, in Houston, you know, clear skies, sunny. And you know, and these guys don't have internet. It was kind of an interesting thought of if something bad happens, but you're in the same area as the bad thing happens, you're more worried about keeping yourself and your family alive than the servers alive. Thankfully, we still had remote access through one of the circuits. And so just logged in. Yeah, we could see the AC clearly failed. So we just started killing all the servers, shutting everything down. We actually had a stretched cluster to another site that still had cooling. And so when we killed that site, everything was HAing to the other site. That was important. But yeah, it was an interesting, from a perspective of disaster planning, it really made real the whole element of what is your disaster plan for your staff? And from then on, you know, whenever we were doing disaster planning, we talk about, okay, who is the person who, when, you know, a hurricane's coming in, that's going to go fly somewhere sunny and be able to work remotely and actually have their family in a safe position while everyone else is probably more concerned with, you know, making sure their house doesn't get, you know, blown down. So that's my fire, flood, or blood lesson for the day.
So what was the lesson? Live in Houston?
No, it's just always make sure you have a contingency plan for your staff. If your data center is in the same place your staff are, that's great until it's not.
Oh, yeah.
Sure to either have, you know, put some staff members somewhere nice and safe and boring like Phoenix or maybe, you know, throw them on the opposite of the side of the world like Perth.
Yeah.
But from that perspective, make part of your planning structure. What are we going to do when our people don't have internet, you know, and they're under the same disaster that the data center is?
Oh, yeah, that was Sandy was a really good cautionary tale for many. I mean, because I remember in Manhattan and in that whole area, there's a lot of
stretch clustering.
Yeah, there's a lot of it. So, you know, no matter what storage vendor you were using, you were going to have some sort of synchronous replication and you were going to be doing some sort of stretch cluster if you wanted to have that, you know, that always on availability. Problem is, when both your primary and your disaster are both getting hit, you know, that doesn't really help you. And that was the cautionary tale of having a tertiary site and using something like SRM so you could be in Houston or somewhere else and still be able to do a failover. And in the case of Sandy, everybody knew it was coming. And so many customers at that moment, they actually chose to do a planned migration prior to the hurricane to avoid this issue, right? So then it would, you know, it's easier to do a planned migration when you know you got a Category 5 coming your way. But yeah.
Yeah. If you have two data centers and they're both on different banks of the Hudson, it's probably going to be turtles all the way down there.
Yeah. Well said. Well said. Awesome. So the rest of this podcast is going to basically be some interviews that we've captured with some folks at various events sharing their fire, flood and blood stories. So take a listen. All right, joining us now to the podcast is no stranger to the podcast. Probably about your fourth time now,
yeah,
Anthony,
it's getting
right?
Up there.
Mr. Anthony Spiteri from Veeam. And we're talking about fire, flood, and blood. So,
flood and blood.
That's it, man. So
sounds
give us
like
your best.
An episode of Game of Thrones.
It could be.
So this was a story. So I used to run a hosting platform in my second to last job, and we were hosting a website or a bunch of websites for a development company. So we're talking about companies that were like Woodside, Chevron, all these big multinational companies. There's some serious website hosting, right? So we're in there one day. All of a sudden, we get these alerts. The alerts are coming in, like, you know, red screen, blue screen. Oh, no, we've got issues. And I'm looking and going, okay, what's going on? Have we lost power or something? Because that's what it looked like.
Yeah.
Log into the web servers. Web servers are up. I log in, have a look. They're Windows, IIS boxes. We're running DFSR between a couple of data centers to have some HA. And then what I see is I log in to the IIS site, and the sites are basically saying there's no files found. So I'm like, okay, that's interesting. Then I log into Explorer, have a look and see. And basically what I see starts to really make me sweat in my heartbeat because...
Or what you didn't see?
Well, what I saw more, because what I was seeing was the folders being like deleted and removed.
Oh,
one
no.
One by one, the folders were disappearing.
Oh,
and I'm like, this is not good. And then all of a sudden in my head, I'm like, what's going on here? Like, your mind just freaks out. And I was like, pull the plug. Pull the plug. Pull the plug. Because my first reaction was that we're being hacked here. Someone's coming in.
Sure.
Is deleting files and whatever. So, you know, we shut off both servers because it was obviously DFSR. Everything was offline. We basically we broke the internet connection at the edge. Everything was offline. What it was though, good old Microsoft DFSR, there was a little bug in it. So what happened was one server basically hadn't been replicating for probably what we found out to be later to be about 6 months. So what was happening, there was a master in the DFSR.
Yeah.
That was cool. But what we did is we rebooted before that the
slave. Oh, it's a
slave.
Split, it's a split brand. And it just
classical split brand,
yeah.
You wouldn't necessarily think about it with DFSR. And when we brought up the other server, because basically it hadn't been updated in 6 months, it just thought, okay, I'm the master now.
I'm
going to replicate across what I think's the good stuff.
I don't know anything about all this new stuff here. Let's get rid of that.
So that was a quite interesting one. And, you know, the website guys were up in arms. And we were running Veeam, though. So the great thing about that is even back then, and it would have been maybe about version 7 or something, I'll tell you what we did. We used instant VM recovery. So okay. One of the great features that we've got.
Nice,
right? And a real world story about
power
it.
Power in a fast.
That's exactly right. We got that that server back up. Everything was up and running. We disconnected DFSR and people were happy, right? But that was, honestly, I can think of that as being my worst ever situation. My heart just popped out.
Well, just line by line, the stuff disappearing.
I thought to myself, it's my Fiji exit. That's it. I'm gone. I'm not working in this industry again. My name is Mud.
Yeah. So I got to ask, did you keep using DFSR after that?
No.
And I was going to say, what was the lesson from this story? But I'm taking it was not use it.
I've met a couple of people who've been, had violent reactions to DFSR. It's like something you catch while on your trip to Fiji and you eat the wrong thing.
Look, it did its job. And who would have thought, you know, that would happen? But, you know, it's just one of those things that you don't test it. You think everything's good and it screws you. But, yeah.
Well, and I've seen other things with DRDB. I, you know, a split brain that nearly ended my career very early.
Yeah.
It's, there's a lot of these systems that do these magical replication. But yep. if you do not understand the fencing and quorum, and if those words don't exist in that application's dictionary.
Or if you're not monitoring event logs.
Yeah, that'll do it.
That'll do it.
But I had that as well. Can I mention them? I can mention them. Yeah, DoubleTake had a brilliant product called GeoReplication as well. So I was using that to replicate SQL servers across country. So from Perth to Sydney, we had geo-redundancy between them. It was pretty cool until it didn't work. And same sort of situation. That was
a lot of those early like file shim that like you'd look under the hood and you're like, wait a minute, this is a VB6 that's somehow running as a file system driver. Like,
but you know what? It was amazing because in that sense, you could run an SQL cluster across like two different zones completely without any common networking.
We need speed of light.
So anyway, so it's fun times. I think I think back in my career, that was the only time where I really thought maybe it's done.
Yeah, maybe it's time to pick up that guitar.
You know, it's we could have instead had you as like a whitewater rafting coach or a yoga instructor, but no,
exactly.
Thankfully, you had good backups.
So. Yeah, and then I work for the company that saved my ass as well. So
I have met multiple VMSCs that have a similar story in the background. Yeah.
I love it. All right, Anthony, thanks, man. Appreciate it, guys.
See ya.
All right, joining us now on Fire, Flood, and Blood Week is Dean Lewis. Dean, how you doing, man?
Hey, how's it going?
Good, good. We're sitting here talking about horror stories, resume-generating events, and lessons learned, more importantly. So I heard you had a story for us.
I've got a few, but there's only one or two I could talk about.
Yeah, you can change the names.
Let's go for the most vivid one, the one that, like, you know, maybe you still kind of wake up at night sweating, thinking, oh, God, it's happening again.
We're here today with Veeam this week. And yep. I think kind of the one that sticks out in my mind to do with Veeam kind of as the outcome of that was an Exchange failure. And what happened was we had the good old story of thin provisioning within VMware, thin provisioning on a NetApp, deduplication.
Which wasn't supported, by the way.
And then,
then Exchange wasn't supported back in, well, actually it is as of 2010 or 2013 now.
Yeah, I can't remember. Yeah. But for the longest time it wasn't, but everybody still did it.
Yep. Yeah. And then obviously the magic thing happened. The NetApp array ran out of space.
Uh-oh.
Oh, did you get a TP stun? Were you using VMFS with the AI? So it kindly paused your VM.
Yeah, but Exchange 2010 didn't like that.
Nope.
Oh, transaction logs.
Yes. And then the next failure after that, so we had to quickly go and find some disks from somewhere. And looking up, we had a DR array. That was the same model. Rip some disks out of there, put them into the array so we could expand the LUM by the smallest amount of gig possible so we could bring everything back online.
Oh, my goodness.
We brought the Exchange server back online and the database refused to mount.
Ooh. That's when you had to run the util.
ESE util.
Yeah.
But honestly, Exchange 2010, if it was throwing that, because it does online defrag, it's perpetually scanning and cleaning itself. If it doesn't mount, you're probably in some pretty... It's not 2003, which would just fall over an ESE util to get it to stand back up. So.
Yep. So no mounting, ESE util, run it for a couple of hours, nothing, extremely slow. So then we sat there and said, okay, what do we do? So we've been using Veeam. Veeam's got the integration with Exchange, all the rest of it. Brilliant. Next step, go and restore it. So the restore for a 2 terabyte mail server took over 2 days to restore.
Ouch. Ouch. You got to get some faster disks on your backup storage, man.
Exactly. That was the point. So one of the biggest things that happened is they tested the backups every now and again, but the smallest VMs, a quick test, quick file level restore, the usual type of thing. Never kind of a DR type scenario of can we bring all of this back the way we expect. So we spent days restoring stuff and you're getting 17, 18, 19 hours in. There might be a bit of a drop on the network or something because it's only coming off a Synology box. Boom, gone. Crashed. Error message within Veeam.
The cheap NASs are not where you want necessarily your primary backups to land.
Yes,
so.
Exactly. And we went through days and days of that. We finally got the server restored, but obviously even though it's application consistent, you still have to do a bit of work to bring it back up. That was an outage for over a week.
So what was the lesson learned on that one?
So the lesson learned was thinking about the design of your backup infrastructure and your backup storage and about how long it takes to restore that data as well. So obviously testing, a VM that's 100 gig, you might go, oh, it took an hour, it's not too bad. But when you've got that 2 terabytes worth of data and you need it, it's a nightmare. Especially something like Exchange, not even file services. So that actually prompted the customer to come back to say, okay, we've been running our backups like this for 5 years. So we've just been added storage onto it, more Synologies, more archive space. let's relook at this from scratch. So one of the things that I started to do over the last couple of years, learning lessons from that, was building something like a HP DL380.
Yeah.
Fill it full of discs on the front, 24 discs, nice RAID 10 or a RAID 6, depending on how much storage you need. Really, really fast local storage. You keep that for your daily restore points. 10 gig networking if possible. You could do the direct backup from SAN over iSCSI fibre channel, and to restore your data as well is really, really quick. We need that near quick time data restore. We even moved the customer onto new storage devices after that as well. So then we had Nimbles there as well. So we started to do the snapshots through the daytime.
Yeah, man.
So after we got everything back up and running, after the week and a half of downtime or so, I had to write a report. I had to do the screenshots of why it took so long. I had to show that the reason why it took so long was right for it to take that long because of the architecture.
Oh, yeah.
And then a year later, you know, we put the new infrastructure in, we changed everything. I then actually just went back through and I did the whole scenario again for them. And we restored everything in less than an hour.
That's the way it's supposed to be.
Well. That's exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and it is all about that testing straight away. And you know,
true testing.
Yeah, to be honest with you, you know, they didn't use features like Shore Backup. They could have done, but we knew kind of deep down in our hearts that if we tried Shore Backup, they didn't have the platform under it to run it on as a test, because it won't be fast enough, which kind of shows you that when you're trying to restore that amount of data, maybe you're not in the right position.
Nice. All right, Dean, thanks for sharing, man. Mr. Ian Sanderson. Ian, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So we're talking fire, flood, and blood this week. And
fire, flood, blood.
Absolutely. And so we've heard some pretty fun stories throughout the week, and I was wondering if you'd share one of your stories for us.
Yeah, well, my story, I guess, ultimately comes round to the importance of checking IQNs.
Nice.
Okay.
Everybody's favorite job.
Yeah.
That's an iSCSI thing, right?
It is an iSCSI thing, yeah. You're right. So the, I guess the TLDR story is Exchange lived on a VMFS data store, and suddenly it didn't. So
did this get attached to a Windows server by any chance?
Not direct. So it was VMFS. There was an Exchange 2003 server running on there. The problem was, because I didn't check, when I dismounted and deleted the VMFS data store, or the one I thought I dismounted and deleted, the IQN and the name of the VMFS store didn't match. So
I was going to say, I might have caused an outage once at some point where, yeah, I assume the documentation was correct. And tracing LUNs and the abstracted LUN numbers, that's always not the most fun thing.
LUNs suck.
I agree.
Oh, man. If only you'd had virtual volumes at the end to end.
Oh, on the sales pitch?
This is probably a bit before VVols.
It was. Well, Exchange 2003. Locally, I was in the middle of a migration to Exchange 2010 at the time. So that migration happened a lot quicker, shall we say.
There was some motivation there.
Yeah, so also it was a bit of a YOLO admin moment. Last thing Friday before leaving work, deleted the volume.
Oh, that's change only Friday, man. Read only Friday, not change only. Read only Friday.
So did you have backups, though?
I did. So we are at the Veeam Vanguard Summit. I did have some Veeam backups I could call on, which saved my ass.
Yeah.
But yeah, always check, double check. Don't assume anything.
One thing I learned after one too many YOLOs that went wrong on detaching LUNs was detach the LUN and then just set a calendar event tomorrow to go delete it. And see if anybody yells in 24 hours.
Always, smoke them out of their holes, yes.
Yeah.
Make sure.
Or if it's a Friday, wait till Monday.
Well, that's a good lesson, but unfortunately, I hadn't learned that lesson at the time. So I was so eager. It was Echologic Storage at the time. I even deleted.
It was such an easy
shift delete.
It was such an easy interface. It made it, you know, that much more comforting. I know what I'm doing.
And this was before the recycle bin as well.
Yeah, oh boy. Ecology,
so. I remember the first time I saw a storage out of the recycle bin, I was like, this isn't for real. Real storage admins, rawr. Like, and then yeah, you see one too many stories of this. You're like, oh, that's why that exists.
So. Yeah, so I learned a lesson.
Well, fortunately, it wasn't a resume-generating event, right?
Or at least that's you landed a better gig after. So.
Well, yeah.
Either way. Thanks, Ian.
Thanks.
Carl Wittmer. So what's your fire, flood, and blood story?
Oh, there are some. We had several outages. Unfortunately, I don't name any company. I don't want to blame someone or do finger pointing.
Sure, names have been changed to protect the innocent. We get it.
there was once a small outage because of a data store. and the data store went down because of heat. And
heat, like too much storage activity, or thermal heat, like someone left a hairdryer on in the data center.
Probably thermal heat, because the infrastructure, or part of the infrastructure, had to be shut down through the provider, as they were installing additional cooling.
So someone unplugged the AC on accident when they were doing some maintenance.
I can't imagine something other, because it's a data center, and the issue was cleared after some minutes. It wasn't a big outage, but they didn't let us know that there is some heat, and we're probably gonna shut down stuff. So it wasn't that kind.
Did you have any monitoring on the servers? Did you see it through like the IPMI or the CIM or anything? Or did you just get a notice from them of, hey, your server's gone. By the way, we were cooking it. We're sorry.
So. Well, we noticed that, of course, in our monitoring, it's infrastructure as a service which we are consuming. So we don't have real hardware access. We are just monitoring some services, and through the vCenter, which we are able to log in, we've got there some kind of monitoring, and we saw that there are some VMs not responding, and that they are red, and
when the CPUs get to medium rare, you know, it's what is it, every 10 degrees Celsius you lose reliability of clock or something. There used to be some formula for, you know, the more you cook to CPU, the worse it.
Yeah, I think you can calculate that as well. Yes, and it was a strange experience, because thankfully we didn't lose any data, but we had some outage. At least some services were not online at that time.
Sure,
and immediately raised support tickets and, hey, what's going on here? And later on, we reached...
You and everyone else whose server is currently grilling, so...
Yeah, absolutely. When we read after that event, we received the root cause analysis from the provider, and it read like a horror story for us. And then it was clear what happened, but we didn't know that before.
So what was the lesson learned here?
Well, increasing some more time into monitoring and building contacts, at least, know the people there, and getting additional, more redundancy, as we had already, to try to avoid that things in the future. And probably also evaluating of the data centers, probably.
Yeah, get it. It's hard to cook multiple data centers at the same time. People can... I feel like I've got a never-ending amount of jokes I can make about, you know, how I want my blade cooked. You know,
bloody.
Yeah, black and blue,
raw.
Yeah, 135 prime. No more.
Very nice. All right, Carl, thanks for your story.
Thank you for the time.
I think the one that stands out is we winded up doing an upgrade on one of our Clarions. And I just remember that we basically lost a tray, like an entire, you know.
A physical tray?
Yeah. Like,
how do you lose a tray?
Well, not lost as in like, it just, the whole thing just went down.
Oh, got it.
Right? Like the discs just kind of would not come back up.
Lights, no blinky blinky.
No blinky blinky whatsoever. No blinky binky, no worky worky, right?
Yeah, the pucker moments are what we
yeah,
like to
and one... I think it was one of the guys. He did some sort of update, and it just took everything completely down. And of course, when your array is down, you can't access anything. And the worst part about that is he did it during the day.
Oh my goodness! Okay, this sounds good. Okay, let's get this recorded. So, you're recording right now.
we're always doing it live. We're always live. And I just remember, like, you know, we having to scramble to figure out, like, okay, what can we do to get this back up? And of course, you know, it's one of those things that when you do that kind of update, there's no really good way to roll back.
Yeah, you're right? Updating firmware, and some of those devices, like tray updates. I've done a tray update on a Clarion and some of those old arrays. A lot of cases, it's like, oh, we're upgrading the firmware. How do we roll this back? In some cases, you discover, like, wait, this device you can't downgrade the firmware on. I've seen that with some NICs and things. And
so I remember we had to contact the vendor, and let's just say that we took a major outage.
Wow, how long was the outage, by the way?
So that started in the middle of the day. We worked all through the night, and I remember we were back up and running the next morning. So I remember working 24 hours around the clock.
Watching the sunrise.
Basically, yeah. And I've never been happier to see green lights come on as a, you know.
Very nice.
The lesson learned today, don't YOLO your firmware update in the middle of the day.
Yeah, well, actually, the lesson there is make sure you read the release notes.
Oh, yeah, buried 4 pages deep. But by the way, this is going to crash your tray.
Yeah, like, that was the other thing. It was like a combination of, like, if you have this version and this type of setup, like, there potentially could be this, right?
I always love it when there's, like, a triple qualifier in release notes. And I learned a long time ago to translate storage vendor of, this may cause some mild availability, means everything's going down and you're going to die.
So apparently we hit the trifecta, and the guy, you know, we asked him, did you read the release notes? He said, oh, yeah, but he never went down to the known issues section, which
I don't know why they didn't get that far.
Too long didn't read.
Yeah, they always focus on, like, at the top of the release notes. Here's all the happy new things. Like, known issues are always way down at the bottom.
I almost feel like it should kind of be, what's new? Here's the known issues, right? Yeah. That way, they're immediately in front of you, and you can,
Nah, let's hide the bad
news. We want to hide those. Yeah, unfortunately, good stuff, man. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Well, joining us on this episode of Fire, Flood, and Blood is VMware's own Paul Brereton. Paul, how you doing, man?
I am great. I'm so happy to be here in Prague with you. Face to face.
Fire, Flood, Blood.
Yeah, I definitely need to get a soundbite for that.
Yeah, no, let's get movie announcer guy.
Yeah.
Like with some explosions or something. Like in the background.
Water, sound effects, people screaming.
Ooh, laser beams. Pew, pew, pew.
So, Paul, we're talking about, it doesn't have to even be fire, flood, or blood. It can be basically any mistake you've made in a data center or someone that you may know, and then ultimately was fixed and what the lesson learned is. So what do you got for us?
The names are changed.
Yes, change the names to protect the innocent.
Yeah, sure. About 8 or 9 years ago, I was asked to, as an IBMer, to rack and stack a whole bunch of gear and install ESXi on it, of course. And back then, we were invited to the deep woods of Mississippi to head to their data center in August. And the surprise was, we get there and it's 48 degrees in the data center. And nobody bothered to mention this key little bit of information.
48 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay.
Correct. So a quick call to the manager at lunch. Hey, we got to go to Walmart and find some winter parkas and some gloves. With the fingertips cut off so you could actually type.
Yeah.
Got all that done. All right. So we survived the morning with our hands cramping up, but by afternoon, we're better equipped. The other surprise was, while these pallets were wrapped in plastic and needed to get up to the temperature of the room, or down to the temperature of the room, which is a good thing, so you don't get condensation.
But so you built a fire.
Yeah, well, kind
of. Is this like you're playing a game of Minecraft or whatever in the data center? Like, we had to cut some wood and...
Or go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, one U pizza box kind of Jenga, you know, rack mounting hundreds, all with the cable management arms, one use, right? So we had our work cut out for us. So that went on for some time, some days. And day two, some sharp metal got me. So you said blood was one of your three there. So mine was a cold story and blood, but...
Cheap rails have spilled more of my blood in the data center than anything else.
So yeah, when you're moving fast, like intentionally to keep your core temperature up so you don't get sluggish and so you can actually type and think, 48 degrees will do that. So we got a workout. It was exciting, but as soon as you sat and sat still too long, things slow down. Those gloves came in handy because I didn't have Band-Aids. So, you know, duct tape, bathroom trip. Luckily, the bathroom is in the data center. Often you can't get to one unless you leave the data center and you're not getting back in until somebody lets you in. I've been through that at many different facilities where work until you drop.
John just brings a bucket.
Yeah, he's got a story here.
No, I was going to say, I've dealt with the cold before. I had a data center. Someone had one of those IBM Z series, the liquid cooled ones, and they didn't do the liquid cooling, so they just dropped the temperature. And we kept parkas in the back of the rack.
Sure, yeah.
Like a meat locker.
Having to leave the data center in that same situation, this was in South Texas. It was in Bryan College Station was the data center. And so you would go in and it would be like 45 degrees or just something ridiculously obnoxiously cold. And then you go outside, it'd be 103. Yep. And you go back and forth. And I'm like, this is not healthy. Like,
Yep.
Paul, thanks for joining us, my friend.
Thank you for having me.
John, we've got another great story on fire, flood, and blood.
Fire, flood, blood.
Yeah.
And joining us this time is Christian Moan. Christian, how you doing, man?
Yeah, good.
I really like your t-shirt, by the way.
Yeah, well, you gave it to me yesterday, so you would, wouldn't you?
So, Christian, I heard over dinner the other night you said you had some pretty scary stories as it pertains to possible data center disasters and maybe mistakes. And so I'm interested in your take, but I also want to hear the lessons learned, the takeaway at the end of it. So let's hear it.
Exactly. So there's no fire and there's no blood, but there's flood.
Oh, flood.
Yeah. So basically, I worked for a shipping company for years.
Okay.
We had this one data center in the building where the company, the rest of the employees were. So it was one level below ground level.
Oh, wow.
But that's where we had a data center. So I've been asking for years for a secondary one in the budgets and stuff. The management said, no, we don't need that. So one day at work, all of a sudden we lost contact with our main file server, which basically had everything pretty much. So I ran up the stairs to get into the data center and figure out what's going on. It didn't respond at all. Opened the door and stepped in, and I stepped in a pool of water.
Oh.
Ooh.
Well, so hopefully the breakers had thrown, yet, you know, GFI or whatever. So. No. Well, he's still here, so I'm assuming.
So the thing was, there was basically a couple of centimeters of water on the entire floor of the entire room.
That's not a good day.
No.
No.
So basically the water came in through the intake for the cooling system. We had just put in a new one, and they had forgotten to kind of
close the loop.
Seal up the tubes or whatever, and the surrounding pieces of it. So this is in Norway, so in February. So there was a lot of snow on the roof of the building. The ground right above the data center had frozen, but then we had some sun. So all of the snow that was melting on the roof hit the ground on the outside.
Yeah.
It couldn't get anywhere because the ground was frozen.
Nowhere to go.
So it went up the wall and in that hole where the throughput for the air conditioning stuff went.
Oh.
So no one thought of that.
Yeah, who would have thought of that?
Snow in the data center.
Yeah. Really cold water, at least. So all of that water that came in physically ran through the physical file server that was at that time on the floor. It's the only physical tower server we still had left that we hadn't put in a rack or virtualized.
Well, you always put your anything that's storage heavy, you put on the bottom because, you know, otherwise you got to go find a lift.
Exactly.
It's always the heaviest thing you got.
We hadn't virtualized this thing yet because basically it was a couple of million files on it. So it took a while. We didn't want to do a P2V on it because there's a lot of legacy stuff.
So then you're tweaking your RoboCopy scripts.
We never finished that. So, well, it was dead. Pretty much. Luckily, there was a small hole in the floor in the data center where some old-style IBM-type cabling had gone through a few years ago. So the water went down there
as
well.
So that was a drain.
So it didn't just rise. Some of it left as well. So basically, the file server died. The rack mount server survived because, well, the water was about as deep as the wheels in the rack. So we had a millimeter or two leeway before the water hit the UPSs. And then all bets would have been off. So
no DR location.
No.
A physical server. So you couldn't migrate it anywhere even if you would have known. So this thing is just DOA.
And just a couple
west.
Center and
basically
a couple
dead
centimeters
in the water.
Too low. Yeah. Dead in the water.
Dead in the water. I like it. So what would have been the clear takeaway obviously is to have a DR plan.
Well, after this, I got management actually asked me if I had planned this because I've been asking for the secondary location for years. And they said no. After this, I got one for some reason.
Yes, I made it snow, boss.
Yeah, exactly. So, we had tape backups of this thing.
We heard all about tape yesterday.
Yeah. So restoring 1.5 million files or something like that from a tape library that was done traditional agent-based backup.
Oh, and file-based, not block. You weren't doing an NDMP or anything.
Exactly.
Because, at least block, it's one big stream rather than all the little metadata operations.
So we had
the poor tape.
Close, between 1.5 million and 2 million files that was supposed to be restored from tape from a library.
That's a lot of cat photos.
That's a lot of cat photos. That's going to shoeshine is what you call it because the tape's like, data file, right, stop, back, stop, back,
it
stop.
Took most part of a week.
Ugh.
24 hours a day for a week to restore all the files. That's one thing. The biggest problem was us, had no idea which files were actually important. We had a backup set of a bunch of files that we really didn't have any knowledge about.
So there was no way to really prioritize.
We hadn't done any of that. Mm. So, and when you start a restore job in TSM of 1.5 million files into a virtual machine, you have no way of controlling which data comes at what time.
Yeah, just take a smoke break and come back in a week.
Yeah, exactly. But the problem was everything else was running, but the main CRM system didn't work for any of our users because in our infinite wisdom, we put the Oracle drivers on a file share because that made it much easier for us to update them. So
that's a lesson learned.
Exactly. That's a point.
Be careful how many application dependencies you put in one fault domain. So.
Yeah, that's one thing. And the other thing is you really have to know what that data is in order to prioritize it. So I had to stop after a few hours running this. We figured out, okay, this, we don't know when things are coming back. So we don't know when our users can actually do something. So it's a shipping company. They had no idea which loads were on which boats and where the boats were going and tech, all of the kind of port stuff and paperwork and nothing.
Well, and you've got time slots where you're supposed to be, and there's all kinds of fines if you're at the dock too long, like that.
Yeah, and they're shipping chemicals. You know, it's dangerous stuff. So
yeah, you've got to maintain coolant on some of that stuff.
Well, that's one thing. Another thing is that I had no idea before I started working in shipping is when you transport something in a tank and you're supposed to transport something else afterwards.
Oh, you've got to clean it out.
Things might not mix well.
Yeah.
And the thing you're putting in there might actually not mix well with the cleaning agent you used to remove the previous load. So there are all sorts of shards and things that go boom.
Boom or create noxious gases.
Yeah, so that might... You know. It could have been a fire as well because of this. But it's flooding.
The flood that caused the fire in Singapore.
Yeah. Like that trifecta.
That could have been a result of this. So I had to abort the restore, just restore the Oracle thing, get that in place so people could actually start working, and then start restoring everything else. So I spent about a week in that data center, 24 hours a day.
Something tells me you had a bunch of takeaways by the end of this experience.
Exactly. So one of the things I think is important now that I hadn't thought of before is actually the restore order of files.
Oh, yeah.
You don't think about that when you work in IT. I mean,
you mash restore all. You got maybe one tier one app and that's it. But all the way down to, I've seen people do this at the virtual machine or even application level, but never the file level the actual restore orders.
Exactly.
Yeah. You make that mistake once.
Yeah.
Excellent story, Christian. I appreciate it, man. Thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
All right, so there you have it, the very first episode of Fire, Flood, and Blood. We're looking to get more stories out there. If you've got a great story, why don't you hit us up on Twitter, DM us at VertSpeaking, send us an email at podcast@vmware.com, or grab us at any industry event when you see us. We would love to hear your stories as well. John, anything else before we take off?
No, I need to go clean my boots, Pete.
Yeah. Nice job, man. All right, man. Put that cowboy hat on the shelf for the next rodeo, buddy. All right. Well, that music tells me it's time to go. And so if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email at podcast@vmware.com. You can subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice by searching Virtually Speaking Podcast. You can catch this and all episodes at bespeakingpodcast.com. A big thanks to all the guys who contributed to our Fire, Flood, and Blood. We're back next week. But until then, bye for now.
Enough of this jibber jabber.